This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the economic and social crisis underway in Puerto Rico.
The country has been stripped bare. Even the airport and highways have been sold. Yet the vulture funds in the United States and the banks that hold the bonds want more.
We'll speak with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern about a new book written by former CIA leaders.
The CIA is trying to rehabilitate its tarnished reputation, but Ray McGovern and the people around him are stopping that.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, some documents have just been made public relating to Augusto Pinochet.
Pinochet was the general in Chile who was responsible for what we call the other 9-11. On 9-11, 1973, he organized with the support of the United States the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. And the documents that have come out show that he was also responsible for the murder of the former ambassador to the United States who moved here after the military coup, named Orlando Letier. He was in a car with his assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, and the car was blown up, killing both of them. Well, new documents have shown that it was Pinochet who ordered the murder. And moreover, to make sure that his role in this was covered up, he also contemplated murdering his chief of intelligence, who organized the murder. What is extraordinary, because we all suspected this, but what is extraordinary that has come out that the United States knew all of this and for the last 30-some years has covered it up.
Thanks, Michael. Joining us in our studio now is First Amendment attorney Carrie Schenkman, who is working, among other things, on the Julian Assange case. Carrie, last week the New York Times, in its headline, said, quote, "Police end monitoring of Assange in London." And when I read that, I was like, this is a great development. They're taking off the police who have been stationed around the clock in front of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Is this accurate, Carrie?
No, Heidi. There has been a major development in the Assange case. The Metropolitan Police Service, which has been monitoring Assange in the embassy for over 3 years, actually admitted last week that it was engaging in not just uniform surveillance around the clock, but also covert surveillance. And the police service said that it will not discuss, quote, what form its continuing operation will take, or the resourcing implications surrounding it.
Carrie, the New York Times article cites a cost to taxpayers in Great Britain of approximately $17 million. So we have to wonder how much of that is for the covert surveillance and how much is for the so-called uniform surveillance. I guess we don't really have a way of knowing.
The UK police themselves say that they will not discuss the cost.
Carrie, does this have any impact on Julian's chance of extradition?
Well, I think what's clear is that the UK is going to arrest him if he walks outside the embassy. And what our legal team has been saying all along is that this case is about the United States. And it's about ongoing attempts to prosecute WikiLeaks for publication work, for protected First Amendment activity in the public interest. And that's unacceptable from a constitutional, from a human rights perspective. And this case has been about the United States all along. And actually, last week, the UK admitted that this case is not about Sweden. The extradition is not about Sweden, because it said and it affirmed that they will arrest him anyway, regardless of what happens in Sweden.
Thank you, Attorney Carrie Schenkman, for this update.
The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is in a social and financial crisis, owing some $73 billion to U.S. banks, hedge funds, and vulture funds. The people of Puerto Rico are extraordinarily impoverished, particularly the children. The government last August failed to make a $58 million debt payment on what they call a moral obligation bond held by U.S. banks and corporations. The crisis reflects centuries-long colonialism, and in particular, the last century of American policies towards Puerto Rico, which favored American investments, which were then taken out of the island. Joining us today is attorney Linda Bakiel, a criminal defense attorney in Puerto Rico and a member of the National Lawyers Guild.
Linda, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you, and we loved your article. Currently, Puerto Rico is undergoing two real crises, economic and social. Can you lay those out for us?
To start with, you mentioned the article. I should say that it's in the October issue of Monthly Review, and it is about the fact that Puerto Rico is in a very deep crisis. The one that gets mentioned in the press up there is the financial crisis, but the real crisis is a social and political one. It's called colonialism. It began in 1898, and it really hasn't improved. It hasn't changed much at all. We have now civil government from the United States instead of military, as was the case for the first about 4 years, absolute military government. But colonialism underdevelops countries, as we well know, and Puerto Rico has been systematically underdeveloped, first by the Spanish for 400 years, and now it's been 120 approximately, going on 125 years for the United States. The economic crisis that gets news is because Puerto Rico's government can't pay its debts. It's currently about $72 billion is the price of the debt. Its economy has been shrinking markedly since 2006. The economy has shrunk 20%. The public debt has increased by 64%. So we're talking about a net loss of 84%. And presently, 36% of Puerto Rico's, the government's income, goes to service the debt. It's the bondholders who are creating a racket up in the United States about Puerto Rico's economic crisis. The social crisis is being denounced very prominently by a coalition of religious authorities of all the major religious views in Puerto Rico. And the Catholic bishops commissioned an article which describes the levels of poverty of children in particular. The poverty level in Puerto Rico is twice that of the poorest state in the United States. Over half of our children live in poverty. More than three quarters of them live in impoverished communities. It's kind of a disaster, maybe not visible to tourists. And the question is, who's responsible and what can we do to get out of it? And the government's initial, you know, response is, well, Big Daddy created the problem, let him get us out of it. And it looks like that's not going to work. That's not going to work because, well, just about a week ago, President Obama said, this was to a meeting of Latino legislators, he said, I care about Puerto Rico. It's a very important issue. Somebody asked him what the federal government was going to do to help the problem, and he said, oh, that's not something the executive can fix. They have to go to Congress. Well, I'm sorry, but that sounds to me really cynical. He can't get anything done in Congress. How does he think that Puerto Rico can?
Puerto Rico is treated as a territory, and it's governed pursuant to the U.S. Constitution, but it seemed to me to be kind of an arbitrary way. Sometimes it's a state, sometimes it's not. I think that because Puerto Rico can't pay its debts as they come due, which is the definition of bankruptcy, they'd like to go bankrupt, but they can't even do that. And they've got a debt that's almost the size of the debt of the country of Greece.
Yes, it is almost the size of the debt is almost the size of the country of Greece, and bankruptcy is not an option because when Congress revised the bankruptcy code in 1984, it didn't say anything at all about Puerto Rico. And when Congress doesn't say anything at all about Puerto Rico, it's anybody's guess what law does or doesn't apply. The default is, as Michael said, Puerto Rico is governed pursuant to what is known as the Territorial Clause of the United States Constitution, and that says that the United States, that Congress has the right to make all necessary laws, regulations, and rules for the territories that it governs. And Puerto Rico is a territory under U.S. law. That was established initially in a series of many cases that took over a decade to resolve. They're known as the insular cases. And they say Puerto Rico is not a state. It's not in line to become a state. It is a non-incorporated territory, something that is an outlier with no other judicial or legal definition. Well, that didn't sit well with the people of Puerto Rico. Those who wanted independence didn't want to be incorporated. Those who wanted statehood did. And many weren't sure what they wanted. And so in 1952, Law 600 was approved by Congress. And that said, we'll let the people of Puerto Rico have their own local government. And they can do that as long as we approve of the Constitution. We set up the form of government. It has to be just like ours, with a Senate and a House of Representatives. It can have a governor. The people can elect their governor. And that was the new regime that was created to avoid the scrutiny of the Decolonization Committee of the United Nations. And the new regime had a name, which in Spanish is called the Estado Libre Asociado, which literally translated means the free associated state. Everyone in Puerto Rico has pointed out from the beginning that it's neither free, it is associated in some way that is not defined, and it is clearly not a state. And so the United States decided that the official translation for free associated state was Commonwealth. God knows why, I guess because it didn't really have any legally binding meaning. And the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States ever since has been whatever Congress says it is, and if it doesn't say, then it's whatever the Supreme Court decides that the territorial clause means in this context. Because it did not include Puerto Rico in the revision of the 1984 version of the bankruptcy code, which gave states the right to authorize municipalities and public corporations the right to file for bankruptcy. So far, the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit has decided, and I think probably the Supreme Court would, too, if it takes certiorari on this question, is that Puerto Rico doesn't have the right to authorize its municipalities and public corporations to file for bankruptcy. No state can file for bankruptcy. So it's not like Detroit. Detroit is a city. Michigan can authorize Detroit to file for bankruptcy, but Puerto Rico can't authorize San Juan. It can't authorize the public utilities, which have the largest share of the debt, the energy corporation, the water corporation, all the basic services, they're running on debt. Of course, the bondholders, the underwriters, have very powerful lobbies, and they are all over Congress and filing all kinds of lawsuits and interventions and appeals to prevent anyone from giving Puerto Rico the right to bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is not the only way to negotiate your way out of debt. Greece entered into a very unfortunate and difficult and terrible negotiation and ended up with an austerity plan, but it didn't file bankruptcy. It negotiated with its creditors. Puerto Rico could do it, but it's not a country, and the debt is not held by Puerto Rico, but by a bazillion different entities that are part of Puerto Rico. So the question and the possible solutions involve perhaps a negotiated settlement away from debt, but it really is insane to consider each entity having to negotiate separately with its creditors. That's probably going to happen with the electric utility, and that is the largest utility debt outstanding. And it is in such terrible condition all around that it's been essentially taken over by a consulting firm from the States that has reorganized other debt-ridden and otherwise corrupt and failing public utilities. And they will probably come up with a complete, I mean, there are in the drawing board a complete restructuring plan that involves restructuring the debt. But a solution for the debt in Puerto Rico as a whole is right now not on the horizon.
Linda, earlier you alluded to some religious groups' involvements, and I know that the Catholic Bishops' Conference commissioned its own study. One thing that Michael and I found very interesting was that one of the authors concluded that neoliberal policies have actually resulted in continued neglect of local industry and agriculture. It was astonishing to hear that, for example, under the so-called Jones Act, all coastal shipping between U.S. ports has to be done by U.S. flagships.
That is a major, major issue and part of the problem. And what is amazing to me is that there is 100% consensus among all the political parties and figures in Puerto Rico, as well as academics, that Jones Act, the part of it, the coastal shipping law, has got to go. Well, what's amazing to me is that that has been a theme of many in the independence movement for almost a century. All of a sudden, everybody is saying to Congress, you've got to repeal the Jones Act. And there are bills in Congress to that effect. And of course, the U.S. shipping industry, Merchant Marines, and there are only two major shipping companies that are responsible for bringing food weekly to Puerto Rico. One of the ships just sank in the last hurricane. Hmm. It just went down with a crew of 33, a bunch of cars, and a week's worth of lettuce and, you know, tomatoes and corn and food imported from the United States. And half of the grocery shelves went bare.
What's amazing is that Puerto Rico is such a rich, right, in terms of the land, well, and most of the food is imported instead, right, of grown 85% there.
85% of the food is imported, and 95% of it could be grown here. And the government of Puerto Rico has only, this current government is the first one that has seriously dedicated itself to looking to ways to promote consumption of Puerto Rican products, identify Puerto Rican products, and kind of publicize the idea that there should be a market for Puerto Rican products. But there is no distribution system. The reason that Puerto Rican products are not competitive here is largely because, two reasons. Economies of scale. Walmart came in here a couple of years ago, and it's a disaster for small growers and small grocers. And the distribution system means that if you pick bananas in Lares today, if they don't get to the hands of a consumer until Friday, they're overripe. You need centers where people can every day take products. They can be processed, refrigerated, and delivered We don't have that.
Linda, can you talk a bit about the strategic value Puerto Rico has had for the United States over this last century?
Well, Puerto Rico was acquired because of its geophysical strategic value. It was the gateway to Latin America. It still has some residual value as a watch point towards the Panama Canal, but essentially it had two pieces of strategic value, certainly during World War II, when many, many bases were established here. There were submarines stored at Roosevelt Roads. It was, it is the easternmost point of the Atlantic that the U.S. can step foot on. Anyway, it sticks out there towards Africa in the Atlantic Ocean, and it was a territory that militarily was extremely important to control as a point of military control for the U.S. Navy until sometime in the 70s and 80s, at least. So it was geophysically strategic. It was also politically strategic because it was seen as the counterpoint to Cuba. It was a Caribbean people. It was a Spanish-speaking country, and the United States could dress it up like a little doll with a U.S. flag and call it democracy and parade it around and say, look, you too could be living well. So it had two very important strategic values. It has lost both. And so my view is nothing would make the United States happier than to just cut the ties and let it wash away. Problem is there are a lot of Puerto Ricans in the United States, and it has given or imposed U.S. citizenship on people born in Puerto Rico. So cutting the umbilical cord is not going to be easy if it's unilateral from up north. And from down here, it has ravaged the economy. It has plundered much of the material wealth. And it has created a population with no experience of self-sufficiency.
The example you give for the way out is the example of what the people did fighting back against the situation in Vieques. And we wanted to ask you about what was the situation there, what did the Puerto Rican people do to get the United States Navy out of there, and what do you think people should do now with respect to this terrible social crisis in Puerto Rico?
Let me say first that I don't have a solution for the terrible social crisis in Puerto Rico. The only solution, the only elements of a solution I know, I think, are those that are bit by bit coming together as a mosaic. I think that the pronouncement by the religious coalition is very, very important. I think it is important that it came from the religious coalition because it breaks through party lines and allows people to unite without being accused of supporting one party or another. The partyocracy here is really extreme and difficult. What did we do in Vieques? In April of 1999, when the Navy bombed its own observation post and killed one of its workers and badly maimed another, the people who were already in Vieques immediately went to the site of this atrocity, and some of them declared they were simply not leaving. Well, they were in the middle of a bombing range, and the Navy's rules were that you could not bomb while there were human beings in the range. In fact, you couldn't bomb when there were turtles in the range, anyway. And they stayed. Essentially, civilians stayed on the bombing range for 4 years until the Navy went away. I mean, it just could not keep people off the range. Over 1,000 people were arrested and jailed for trespassing on land. Some of them were Viequenses whose parents had owned the land before the Navy threw them out. And because people were willing to give up their liberty and assert their right to their own land and not be bombed anymore, the U.S. military ended up being powerless. The Navy was powerless, and it had to get out. You know, there was a real focal point there. There was a dramatic thing that happened, a death. There was a clear cause, a bomb, and it was, the injustice was just so obvious, and it was the culmination of many deaths and many injustices by the Navy in Vieques. And it totally, you know, everyone in Vieques got it immediately, and many people, especially independentistas in the main island who had been active in struggles to get the Navy out of Vieques for many, many years, by 1940s, Don Pedro Albizu Campos was there. It was an easier target. It was a huge, difficult force, the U.S. Navy, but it was a single focus. Here we have underwriters whom nobody knows who they are. They aren't here. Debt is a very amorphous thing. It is hugely complicated. It is divided all over the place. And there are some civilians who are being hurt by this. There are bondholders from municipal bonds, triple-exempt municipal bonds. Many funds advised Puerto Rican residents and public employees to invest in these bonds, so their retirement is being affected. It's a very, very complex problem. The only thing that is clear and in common with Vieques is that the people of Puerto Rico have got to find some points about which we can speak with a single voice. That single voice has got to say, the workers can't pay, the children can't pay, the poor people can't pay. The rich have got to pay for this mess, and the rich are not living in Puerto Rico by and large. It is the bondholders who have got to take less so that the children can eat.
On that note, Linda Bakil, we want to thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we will follow the situation there, and we'll get back to you on it. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you very much. It's always good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
Former CIA leaders responsible for allowing torture to become part of the 21st century landscape are seeking to rehabilitate their sullied reputations with the release of a new book. It's called Rebuttal: The CIA Responds to the Senate Intelligence Committee's Study of Its Detention and Interrogation Program. The authors claim that the primary allegations against them stem from a partisan report issued by Democrats from the Senate Intelligence Committee. In fact, the Senate Intelligence Report on Torture enjoyed bipartisan support. But some caution that if the public doesn't carefully read the extensively footnoted report, it may be easy for many to believe that the CIA officers are victims of a political witch hunt. As well, these officers seem to rely on the erroneous fact that a segment of our population continues to believe that the practice of torture is effective in gleaning information important to national security. Here to talk about the new book Rebuttal is Ray McGovern, former U.S. Army Infantry Intelligence Officer and CIA analyst, now retired. Ray was the person who briefed George Bush the Senior in his office every day on intelligence matters. Ray McGovern, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We're curious what your initial reactions were to the release of the new book, Rebuttal: The CIA Responds to the Senate Intelligence Committee Study of Its Detention and Interrogation Program.
Well, Heidi, I would want to say that I was astounded and embarrassed, but you know, this kind of thing, this kind of shameless attitude where the truth is played fast and loose with, when a five-year study quoting original CIA documents comes out and tells the real story, I wish I could say I was surprised that former intelligence directors and sub-directors or whatever have chosen to try to rebut that, but I'm not surprised. You know, I have to say that President Obama really muffed it when he came into office and left the torturers in charge of the CIA. That was, I'm trying to search for an adjective that I can say on the radio here. That surprised me and disappointed me greatly, because they knew then they could get off the hook. Now, they are liable, as you know, you being lawyers. And several of them have had some really bad experiences, like those 30-so folks in Rome who kidnapped that fellow off the streets of Milan, like George Bush, who had to cancel a visit to Geneva where he was going to make a big speech and get a big award, because you guys and others were prepared to deal with that under this international law, where if a domestic law country isn't up to it or chickens out and doesn't try people like Pinochet or people like George Tenet or Richard Cheney, then the international people can take over. And that happened to Rumsfeld in Paris. So there is some hope. At least people realize that there's still an international law consortium that would like to put the torturers where they belong. And we can hope that that might eventuate in the future.
I think that our major problem is that the idea that torture works, that it's kept us safe, is accepted by a lot of people in the United States. I know you don't accept that, and there are a lot of people who know quite a lot about this. I know you quote in your memorandum General John Kimmins, and Kimmins says it doesn't work. Talk to us about that. Why do you think they were able to get away with this so far?
No guts on the part of Obama. It's that simple. No guts and fear. This is really hard to say or to stomach, but I have it on good authority that when some progressive, well-heeled people on whom Barack Obama depends for hefty contributions, they had him around a small table to dinner several years ago, and they said, you know, you're supposed to be progressive. Why is it you do all these things? And they were pinging on him so often that he finally got up and he said, don't you people remember what happened to Dr. King? Now, I have the second hand, but my first hand source is Golden, okay? I'm not surprised that he would feel that way, but I don't think he should have run to be president if he was going to be that fearful. And a lot of the things that you can see, his defense of the clear abrogation of the Fourth Amendment by NSA, a lot of other things that he has been either tricked into lying about or consciously lies about, can only be explained, in my view, by the fact that he's afraid of them.
I would concur with you, but I would also say, you know, with good reason. Those of us who followed the unraveling of the cover-up, the Kennedy assassination, know that this is not an organization to be trifled with. You quote in your memo General John Kimmons, the former Deputy Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they asked him if good intelligence could be obtained from abusive practices, and he replied, "I'm absolutely convinced the answer to that is no. No good intelligence is going to come from abusive practices. I think history tells us that. I think the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, hard years, tells us that."
Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, Michael, he was head of Army Intelligence, okay? Like, he was on top of all of Army Intelligence. And he was a three-star. Now, why is he such a gutsy guy? Well, because he said it the way it is. And remember that he said no good intelligence is going to come, no reliable intelligence, okay? And he said that on the same day that he knew the President of the United States, right across the river in the White House, was going to brag about the virtues of enhanced interrogation techniques. That took a lot of guts, okay?
Yeah.
Now, why do I emphasize good? Because, you know, your listeners need to know that there is one important aspect in which torture works like a charm, okay? Now, if you want to get somebody to swear that Saddam Hussein is training al-Qaeda in biological, chemical, and explosive warfare, you can do that from torture. And this is not theoretical. That's precisely what was done with a Libyan named Alibi. They couldn't get him to, quote, confess, end quote. So they sent up the Egyptians. Now, the Egyptians have more experience with these kinds of enhanced interrogation techniques. And sure enough, they got Alibi to admit that he was a travel agent. And he sent all manner of people up from al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein. Wow. Now, isn't that great? The President of the United States used that 3 days later, 3 days before Congress voted to authorize a war on Iraq. Used that in public in a major speech. Okay, now, what happened to Alibi? Well, somehow they let him go, and 3 months later he said, "Yeah, that's a crock. I only said that because I wanted him to stop the torture." He ended up in a Libyan prison, a devout Muslim. He is said to have, quote, committed suicide, end quote. So all I'm saying here is that was no mistake. That wasn't, intelligence that was mistaken. That was intelligence, in quotes, gotten from torture. Very useful intelligence because it helped George Bush and Dick Cheney sell this war to Congress. It was one of those pieces where the intelligence apparatus deliberately set out under Bush and Cheney's directions to really deceive Congress, our elected representatives, out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. I mean, that's as bad as it gets. That's why we, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, set up our little alumni organization, if you can call it that. We don't go out drinking. We don't have lecturers. We just work real hard to try to be a check on the people who are left in the intelligence community who still lie, and most of those now are in NSA.
Ray, can you talk a bit about how the government oversees and really holds accountable the CIA and the U.S. intelligence community? Or does it?
I was going to say, Heidi, that's a real easy one. It doesn't. Now, we used to have what we call the oversight committees, right? Well, now they're the overlook committees. I mean, they are completely complicit in all this, and that happened in spades when the Republicans were chairing all these committees. Now, one good example of that is when Pat Roberts from Kansas, Republican, was head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he allowed all manner of things to happen, including the bogus charges that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now, as soon as the Democrats took over, a five-year study by his intelligence staff that had been sort of put in the side by Pat Roberts was issued by Jay Rockefeller, who took his place. And Jay Rockefeller introducing this bipartisan study, mind you, with Chuck Hagel and Olympia Snow joining in the conclusion, he said the intelligence used to justify the war against Iraq was, quote, unsubstantiated, comma, contradicted, comma, or even non-existent, period, end quote. Now, I ask you, what does non-existent intelligence look like?
Ray McGovern, you've compiled a really impressive list of people that signed this memorandum to President Obama. Can you talk about who signed it?
Sure. Well, in addition to the usual suspects, in which I include myself, we had some really, really interesting people. For example, Valerie Plame Wilson, Larry Wilkerson, who was chief of staff to Colin Powell, Ali Soufan, who was the FBI interrogator, who used the old tried and tested techniques to get real information from Abu Zubaydah and other detainees, Scott Ritter, John Kiriakou, Larry Johnson, who's still very well plugged in, Dan Ellsberg, Glenn Carl, who worked for the CIA and quit because they asked him to enhance interrogation techniques. And one other I mentioned, Matthew Alexander. Now, I never knew his name. That's a pseudonym until he came out of the woodwork when he saw what we were doing. His name is Tony Camerino. He was, and I think still is, an Air Force major. And he was the fellow who was in charge of interrogating jihadists who came into Iraq after Abu Ghraib disclosures. And he reported, and this is interesting, that 90% of them, when asked why they came into Iraq to do the jihad, told their interrogators two reasons, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So if we want to have a perpetual war, what they're talking about, a 30 years war, without any sense of history here, a 30 years war against terror, well, a good way to do that is not to prosecute the torturers and to, you know, let other people go scot-free and, you know, to make it so that the U.S. looks as though it's really oblivious to the crimes that have been committed.
I want to talk briefly about the reputation of the CIA and to what extent does the agency go to sort of protect that reputation?
To inordinate lengths, as you would imagine. The thing that most people don't understand is that you have two agencies here. They're both called the CIA, but they're very different. The one was created by President Truman so there'd be one central place where one inbox would be filled with all the information relevant to a certain country or issue, and that person would be able to tell the president without fear or favor what he thought was going on, what she thought was going on in the world. Now, in an accident of history, the people who were really good at overthrowing governments and jumping in between enemy lines and so forth, the old OSS during World War II, they came back, and to great applause, they said, well, thanks a lot, but do you want us to hang around? Our specialty is overthrowing governments. Because the people in Congress said, oh, well, the Russians are overthrowing governments. We have to have that capability. Long story short, one sentence was added to the National Security Act in 1947, and it says, the Director of Central Intelligence shall pursue such other functions and duties related to intelligence, which the president shall from time to time direct, period, end quote. Now, that doesn't excuse the CIA from crimes in this country, but if you have a corrupt or a, you know, unconscionable president, and you have a toady, unconscionable toady like George Tenet, well, you can look at that sentence and say, well, you know, the president tells me I've got to torture people. The president tells me I have to forge documentation to justify a war. Well, I'm bound by the sentence which says that the director shall perform other functions and duties that the president shall from time to time direct. Again, it's twisted. It's crazy. It's one sentence in legislation that set up a analysis unit to give the president a good idea what's going on in the world. So most people think of the CIA as people who, you know, torture people or people who jump in behind lines and overthrow governments. And that's true of one CIA. But our part, the analysis part, I'll tell you, when I came on under John Kennedy, I couldn't go to that other part of the building. There were turnstiles there. And if I didn't have certification, all manner of badges and stuff, I couldn't go there, and they couldn't come where I was working. That's how hermetically sealed we were, one from the other. So long-winded answer to your question, CIA does really, really good work when they have an honest management system. And I don't have to cite anything more than the national intelligence estimate that my former colleagues did on Iran. Now, after the debacle on Iraq, someone said, hey, let's get an honest fellow to run the estimate on Iran, because Bush and Cheney are aiming to do Iran, so to speak, during their last year in office, 2008. And they had to go to the State Department, and a fellow named Tom Finger, who was not only really sharp as could be, but he had all kinds of integrity. He worked for a year, and at the end of 2007, the estimate came out, and this was unanimous, expressed, quote, with high confidence, end quote, Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. That was in George Bush's own words. Take a look at his memoir. An eye-popping estimate, and it deprived me of the military option. These are quotes. Last quote. For how can I authorize U.S. forces to strike the nuclear facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? Question mark. Close quote. Well, bummer, huh? Bummer.
Yeah, it's too bad.
He must have written that himself.
Ray, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you two questions. I just have one as an observation that the enhanced interrogation techniques is a term that came out of Nazi Germany. Am I right about that?
Yeah, it's Verschärfte Vernehmung, the two German words, and it's literally what it means. And if you look at the Gestapo handbook, they're the same techniques.
Yeah, really. Ray, last question. What's it going to take to bring these criminals to justice?
Well, it's going to take, in my view, putting our bodies into it. And this is a problem larger than the torture problem. It seems to me that the government itself is so afraid of us that they could send the U.S. Army here into this apartment and take me away and put me in Guantanamo without charge, jury, or anything else. But not forever now, mind you, just till the end of the war on terror, okay? That legislation makes that possible. For the first time since the Civil War, the Army can be used in this kind of function. That's scary. It hasn't been used yet, but they can use it. Everything Hitler did was quite legal because he changed the law. So what I think we need to do is make sure that we put our bodies into it. People say, well, I think of Cesar Chavez. He used to always say, you know, really, thanks a lot for your op-eds and all of those speeches are really great. But without action, nothing's going to happen. And you say, oh, there aren't enough of us. And I say, there are enough of us. But like I said before, without action, nothing's going to happen. Now, everybody's got to figure out how they're going to do that action. But in my view, it's going to take us getting out in the streets, making sure that that people like the torturers do not go unpunished. And it's a tall order. But if we don't do that, well, Dr. King famously said, there is such a thing as too late. And I'm afraid we're approaching that stage.
Well, that's a sobering thought to end this interview on, Ray McGovern. We thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and keep up the good work.
Well, you're most welcome.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
You, Heidi.
Bye-bye.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Bye. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.